You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 21st, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ryan Grimm from The Intercept on the ticking time bomb that is the commercial real estate market. Meanwhile, Derek Chauvin found guilty on three counts of homicide, including two counts of murder and one of manslaughter. DOJ to announce a probe into Minneapolis's policing practices. And the question is, will any of this make police reform more or less likely? New report, the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General bucked staffers' recommendations and refused to investigate the Lafayette Square DHS cop riot. Joe Biden to propose cutting U.S. emissions in half by 2030. President Joe Manchin mocks the $15 minimum wage to restaurant lobbyists. Meanwhile, more calls for the United States to waive patents in order to vaccinate the world as Johnson & Johnson announces it made over $100 million last quarter with a rollout of its vaccine. AOC and Markey reintroduced the Green New Deal, updated with a Green New Deal core. And lastly, Ted Nugent, who only months ago claimed this pandemic was fake, announces he has COVID. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Oop. Oh, there you go. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Glad you could make it. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. Sam, how are you? Big news day yesterday after our show wrapped.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, the obviously a sense of relief in the sense that, you know, everyone saw the 9 minutes of video footage. I don't know if everyone, but the vast majority of the country saw the 9 minutes of video footage. And I think there was a very reasonable sense amongst people that if this doesn't constitute murder, then what could constitute murder? And we should say that, you know, I think the numbers are a little bit difficult to find because we don't keep statistics on this. But there have been less than a half a dozen police convictions of murder while on duty out of the, depending on how you calculate it, 10 to 15,000 killings by police over the past 15, 20 years. Like I say, it depends on whose statistics you're going to believe, or because there just isn't, we don't, as a country, keep these statistics, which in and of itself, I think, is indicative of the of a problem, because we probably don't want to know what the numbers are. And despite the fact that in this one instance, there is there has been accountability and justice, at least so far, has been served. There's three other officers who are going to be on trial later in the summer for their essentially just sitting idly by and watching Derek Chauvin kill.
And not reporting it. I mean, I know this might not be the actual charge on trial, but after it was over, none of them turned him in either. So
exactly. And of course, you know, we all know that this is that without that videotape that a 17-year-old woman took, probably none of this happens. I mean, we saw how the Minneapolis PD reported the murder day of. And here's the biggest point as to why, like, you know, this is obviously this is one of those necessary but wildly insufficient in terms of really dealing with the problem of both policing and racism. And because there is a general problem with policing, it is like many other things in this country, exacerbated because of race. And when the racism of the police and the general authority that they take and they have and the lack of accountability come together, this is what you get. So there needs to be a systemic wholesale change to what constitutes policing in this country and the areas in which they are allowed to sort of like function need to be dramatically limited.
In my view, a dismantlement of the current policing structure and building something new, because yes, policing exacerbates existing racism, but it's this structure of policing is built on white supremacy.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And just to give you a sense of how sort of narrow or unique and you know, this situation is in terms of this outcome. People should understand that the reason why Derek Chauvin was prosecuted is because at one point, Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota, made the decision to hand this over, to take it from the local DA and hand it over essentially to Keith Ellison, who is the attorney general of the state of Minnesota. You can look at and just pop this up. There was a thread by Justin J. M. 1.
From last year, just kind of documenting here, just the differences. I didn't mean to cut you off. The DA and Keith Ellison's complaint against Chauvin.
This is Justin Miller, and he and Emma had saved this, and it's very it really illustrates why we got this ruling and why we don't get rulings like this, and why this. The fact that there has been justice in this narrow circumstance really does not have implications in and of itself for the wider change in policing that has to happen. There are massive discrepancies in the DA's complaint versus the attorney general's complaint.
Keith Ellison deserves enormous credit, in my view. I mean, this, I think, highlights a larger problem, as you're alluding to. The fact of the matter is that attorney generals throughout the country and DAs throughout the country have been historically overwhelmingly more likely to side with police officers who they know and work with in these instances. And Ellison is a progressive who became attorney general, and that changed the game. But he is by far an exception to the rule.
Without a doubt. I mean, we see this all the time. The, you know, there's a conflict of interest, broadly speaking, with these prosecutors and the police. And they the way that they simply frame the complaint in many respects essentially determines the trajectory and, you know, where you're going to land in terms of a conviction. Just, you know, just off the top, there's just a couple of things here. The DA wrote that Mr. Floyd actively resisted being handcuffed. The AG did not say, just left that out because they did not find that that was the case. The DA claim, you know, once handcuffed, Mr. Floyd, quote, became compliant and walked with Officer Lane. Well, the AG doesn't say became compliant because the assumption was that he was compliant. And in fact, The AG included that Mr. Floyd sat down and he said, thank you, man, and was calm. So the characterization of what was going on there, why, you know, all leading up to that moment where Chauvin puts his knee on his neck.
Yeah, this just goes to show, like, when Ben Shapiro talks about the facts of the case, that you cannot trust the facts as established by police. They just lie about using, like, suggestive language.
And the DA here, too. The DA writes, officers made attempts to put Floyd in the car. And, quote, he struggled with officers by intentionally falling down. The AG writes, officers were trying to force Floyd in when he said he could not breathe.
Which we saw was documented.
Well, and then all of this stuff becomes more established when you actually see some video. AG quotes Floyd as saying, I'm about to die. The DA does not have that quote. The DA video shows Mr. Floyd continue to move and breathe at 8:24, 24 seconds with Mr. Floyd stopped breathing. And then the AG wrote, while Mr. Floyd showed slight movements, his movements and sounds decreased until 8:24, 24. Mr. Floyd stopped moving. So the point is that this report in and of itself essentially provides the context in which Chauvin murdered Floyd. And what he should have known and what the other cops should have known at that moment. And again, this is, we cannot rely on having an attorney general who is not caught up in their conflict of interest in maintaining their relationship with their cops to deal with this issue writ large. It is good in this situation, but it is completely narrow. And the problem is that we see from our politicians to our media, and I'm even talking the ones that are ostensibly sympathetic to this.
Nancy Pelosi, key, you know, example from yesterday.
Do not understand this concept. In fact, here is Nancy Pelosi with her first statement. And she sort of like, you know, smoothed it over with a tweet later. But I mean, just like this. And we should say Axios is now reporting that at least staffers in the House and the Senate are saying this alleviates the pressure for any type of systemic reform,
which is the exact opposite
of what's
attitude.
Necessary.
Yes,
right.
That is necessary.
Thank you, George Floyd, for sacrificing your life for justice, for being there to call out to your mom. How heartbreaking was that? Call out for your mom. I can't breathe. But because of you and because of thousands, millions of people around the world who came out for justice, your name will always be synonymous with justice.
Now, he sacrificed himself so his murderer could be convicted?
Let's just even be really, really generous and say that was poorly framed. But the concept behind it is, I mean, you've just made it clear the absurdity of that statement, but the concept behind it, that this has provided justice outside of the narrow confines of someone being held accountable for murdering somebody, is absurd. It's absurd.
It shows how she's, you know, overstating the impact of this outcome and how this is the exact dynamic that you just said. How Democrats like her think, okay, great, justice in this case, magic bullet or silver bullet, this is going to solve things. And as we saw, that I believe there was a report that as the verdict was being handed down, another person was shot by police.
That's a different situation. That woman had a knife in her hand, was about to, it looks like,
no,
in terms of the video.
No, different case, but, or maybe, I'm
no,
not
that's
sure.
In Ohio. But the point is, it doesn't, the idea that there is some greater form of justice that is taking place in this moment, beyond the fact that, yes, the murderer was convicted, is absurd. And trying to make it into that misses the entire point totally, that there is a problem that is greater than George Floyd, that is that has been going on for decades upon decades upon decades before George Floyd was even born, never mind since he's been murdered, and that it's much broader and systemic problem. There is an example of a politician not getting it right. Here's an example of a news person also completely missing the point. And, you know, I imagine is sympathetic to this situation, but completely oblivious to the sort of broader systemic problems. This is Brian Williams, and he's interviewing. Who is the guy that he's who's speaking? Brendan.
Cedric Alexander.
Okay, and so Alexander is basically outlining, essentially, like, look, one point earlier, he says, you know, we obviously, we have a problem with the police that populate these police departments. But what we also have a problem with is the concept of policing, that we are over-policing people, et cetera, et cetera. And here is... Brian Williams responding to this guy.
We're moving into a new age. So regardless of what outcome of this particular verdict may happen to be, one thing is for certain here is that we're all going to have to keep our foot on the gas and look not just for reform and reimagining police, which are words that to me are becoming dated, but we're going to have to define public safety in a very different way than what we have in the past. And what does that mean? And what is it that we want police officers to do going forward?
Pause it right there.
Today can be
pause it right there. So what he's saying is that, like, we know we've heard reform. The Minneapolis Police Department was under, you know, had a reform program. We need to fundamentally change the way that police exist in our society and what we look to police to do, because it's not working. It's not working. Period, broadly speaking. And then, as if like there is an allergy to looking at the systemic implications of this stuff, watch the response on this.
The beginning of that. And, so we look forward to
I'll do you one better. I'll say that the George Floyd case has made activists out of average citizens who never imagined that they would be marching on the streets during the summer in a pandemic, but they did. And to combine everything you just said, I hope some small percentage of the mostly young people who have flooded the streets of our country for good reason, feeling propelled and compelled to become activists, I hope it occurs to some of them that perhaps a way to change policing is to get involved, change it from the inside, enact the changes to the policies that they're protesting. That would be a great influx of a population into the policing community. Cedric Alexander.
That was not, in fact, one better.
That was actually, yes, significantly worse. Now, if he had even stopped and said, like, you know, these people, if his implication was like, I hope these people get involved in government, and then, but he said the police community. I mean, there is a massive blind spot, or, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to be sort of somewhat charitable, but the most charitable perspective on this is I'm just incapable of registering the idea that this system is fundamentally wrong and broken, and not even broken, because broken implies it's not working the way that it's supposed to, that the system as designed does not function in the proper way. And it's as if that they, you know, politicians, the media, and this is the best of the lot. Let's go to the worst of the lot when we're talking about, you know, sort of like, you know, what dominates the culture, you know, between the news and the politicians on these issues, at least in terms of like the way the dominant narrative. This is all you get. So on one end of the spectrum, it's we don't need anything systemic. We just need better people in there. And or that one case ends up bringing some sense of like broad justice that is applicable to changing things. Or the other end of it is, of course, is that like this is a travesty. And here is Tucker Carlson to bring in that perspective.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. The jury in the Derek Chauvin trial came to a unanimous and unequivocal verdict this afternoon. Please don't hurt us. The jurors spoke for many in this country. Everyone understood perfectly well the consequences of an acquittal in this case. After nearly a year of burning and looting and murder by BLM, that was never in doubt. Last night, 2,000 miles from Minneapolis, police in Los Angeles preemptively blocked roads. Why? They knew what would happen if Derek Chauvin got off. In the end, he didn't get off. If given the maximum sentence under the law, he will spend the rest of his life in prison. Is that a fair punishment? Is the officer guilty of the specific crimes for which he was just convicted? We can debate all that, and over this hour we will. But here's what we can't debate. No mob has the right to destroy our cities. Not under any circumstances, not for any reason. No politician or media figure has the right to intimidate a jury. And no political party.
I just hope people understand the delicious irony of him with the backdrop of the Capitol building.
Yeah.
When you talk about a mob intimidating a jury, or let's say like a set of politicians, or destroying a building, as it were. But again, like, to report this outcome of the case with the primary implication that the only reason why they found this guy, Chauvin, who stuck his knee on the back of a neck of a person lying on the ground,
he said, "I can't for breathe no reason, four times
for no reason." The only reason why the jury found them guilty was because they were afraid. Is rather twisted, but let him finish his.
But just quickly, Sam, you have to be fair to him. He had about 400 chyrons ready about rioting and looting, and since that didn't happen, he probably had to rewrite this on the fly.
That's true. We're still going with the rioting.
Yeah, he kind of shoehorned that in anyway.
Any reason. No politician or media figure has the right to intimidate a jury. And no political party has the right to impose a different standard of justice on its own supporters. Those things are unacceptable in America. All of them are happening now. If they continue to happen, decent, productive people will leave. The country as we knew it will be over. So we must stop this current insanity. It's an attack on civilization. At stake is far more than the future of Derek Chauvin or the memory of George Floyd. At stake is America.
Yeah.
Where are all these people going to go? These hardworking, decent people are going to go where there's no protests when there's massive injustice, or even, frankly, in many places, just not massive, just injustice.
He's really stretching there. But back quickly to the Brian Williams clip, because, again, as you mentioned, I think he's well-intentioned. There is going to be, and we have to resist it with every turn, a compulsive desire to make this an individualistic focus, how just this one individual case, say this one BLM protester who joins a police force can change everything. And what the whole focus should be, and this is why, you know, you have to treat this as a moment of accountability and not as justice. What needs to happen is a dismantling of the policing system and a rebuilding of it, and in a different vision. And that's where the focus always should be. And I know that might freak out Tucker Carlson in every which way, but he's trying with all of his might to make sure the focus is on something else, on rioting, looting, etc. And unfortunately, Nancy Pelosi, Brian Williams, in their own way, willing or otherwise, are doing the same thing in a different flavor, making it just about this one case as opposed to what is needed, which is systemic overhaul.
Indeed. All right. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ryan Grimm about a potential replay of the financial crisis in 2008, but this time in commercial real estate. We'll be right back in just a moment. And folks, it's time for Emma's favorite ad. What are you getting your mother for Mother's Day this year, Emma?
I haven't decided yet.
Well, I've got a suggestion for you.
I know you do.
A bidet. Get a bidet from Hello Tushy. You can bring your mom into the future. Really, actually, frankly, it's also the past. I mean, it's just for whatever reason in the United States, we just didn't get the memo. But now the brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment. It is stylish. It is eco-friendly. It is super easy to install. And it's going to help her both stop flushing her retirement down in reams and reams of toilet paper. But it also is going to be a much more pleasant experience, frankly, and far more hygienic. And the Hello Tushy 3.0, it doesn't just cleanse your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself, before and after it's used with the Smart Spray automatic self-cleaning nozzle. And when they say anybody can put this together, they mean it. It's super easy. Even your folks can do it. It attaches to your existing toilet. It requires no new electricity, no electricity, period. It requires no new plumbing. You don't need any tech support or FaceTimes or anything like that. It's literally you unscrew a couple of things and you screw them back on and that's it. Plus, every Hello Tushy bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. If your mom already has one, then get her an upgrade to the Hello Tushy 3.0. If she's new to the revolution, have her join millions of happy Hello Tushy customers for a clean butt with every flush. Like we talk about this all the time. You get something on your hands, you don't wipe it with a dry piece of paper. You wash it with water. That's the concept, and it has worked in, I don't know what percentage of the world around the world have figured that out, but we're late to the game here in America, and totally understandable. You don't want to go out and spend whatever it is, $1,500 on a bidet or $2,000, whatever it would take in terms of the plumbing. This is your way to sort of like ease into it, and frankly, it's where I'm staying. I'm not laying down whatever massive amount I need to get a full-on bidet.
Yeah,
I have one now in my toilet with the Hello Tushy. So, and listen, so here's a special offer for our listeners at HelloTushy.com/majority. You get 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority, 10% off. Check it out. All right. I want to welcome back to the program, Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept, also author of We Got People.
Great book.
Ryan Grimm is joining us now. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Lovely to be here.
And before we get into your story, your sense of what you think might come out of the, if anything, or what the biggest takeaway you have from the verdict coming from the Derek Chauvin trial, just briefly, and then we'll get into your story, which is one that I'm incredibly interested in, frankly.
It's hard to know exactly, and I think we'll know more in the next couple of weeks, but it seems like the police and the kind of general defenders of the police, for the most part, you know, with some exceptions, made the decision fairly early on that they were going to cut this guy loose, you know, that this was just a bridge too far, that it had every single element. You know, it was absolutely horrifying for people to watch. His dead eyes, I think, played a significant role, both probably in the jury's verdict, but also in kind of the world's verdict. The fact that he continued, you know, kneeling on him for such a long, long time after he was completely unresponsive, and the complete divergence from from policy led people to say, you know what, this is not a fight we're going to win, so let's not fight it. And so because they didn't fight it, it becomes harder to know, you know, what this says about the debate over policing and police reform going forward, because it's not as if they're going to stop fighting all prosecutions of police misconduct. And you know, as you saw out of Columbus, Ohio, we're going to get new ones. Get new ones coming.
Yeah. And the bottom line is, I just think that, if Keith Ellison does not get this case, it's a much different, because the relationship between DAs and police is, broadly speaking, is just not one that is going to bring about, any type of justice in these situations. And it's not just a question of justice. It's also a question of like basically saying like, hey, we're going to hold you to account. So, you know, at one point your behavior has got to change, or right, you're being held to account.
And there aren't many Keith Ellisons.
No.
Yeah.
And if you look in Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell, you know, helped installed his protege, Daniel Cameron, you saw a completely different pattern unfold. There no video with Breonna Taylor, and that, as we know, makes a difference in our media age. But you're absolutely right, and just your run of the mill Democratic AG is not going to do it either.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think just to your point, police are happy to throw one guy overboard in order to avoid the conversation about more systemic critique. Like, you know, they were happy to throw him as chum.
And even coming out of the gate, there were a lot of police who weren't making a cynical calculation. You know, you saw a lot of police come forward and be like, this was wrong. Like, this was bad. It wasn't that, you know, some of them, I think, stepped back and looked at all the factors and said, this is not a fight that's worth having. But others just viscerally looked at it and said, this is not what policing is.
All right. Well, let's turn our attention to a,
or should be, I should say.
Indeed. All right. So let's turn our attention to a piece that you wrote with John Schwartz over at The Intercept. Wall Street's cooked books fueled the financial crisis in 2008. It's happening again. And this whole sector of commercial real estate, for the past year, I've been hearing about problems in this sector. I mean, both, like, what you're outlining here is pure on fraud, but there's also, like, I think other sort of other issues in that marketplace. But let's talk about this, because this is massive. Tell us how you started to pursue this fraud in what is the commercial real estate, I guess, loan market.
Right. I was contacted around a year ago, actually, by a CMBS analyst, you know, this commercial mortgage-backed security analyst, who named John Flynn, who is, he's public, he's on the record, he's in the story, you know, said that he had spent several years in investigating these very specific loans, like basically looking at the actual documents that underlie these securities, trying to figure out, you know, how it was that these loans that when he used to work at a credit rating agency, he saw come across his desk and thought were sketchy 10 years ago. Now he's seeing them as an analyst come across his desk again, getting refinanced and at even better rates. And so he started wondering, how is this even possible? These were junk 10 years ago. They can't be any better now. And so he went about this incredibly difficult and laborious forensic accounting, trying to compare previous documents related to a particular mortgage for a commercial property with the current ones. And often he found that there appeared to be purposeful obfuscation to make it harder for people to find them. So for instance,
let me stop. I just want to just go back a little bit before we get to the indications of fraud that he's found.
Right.
So when you say, like, when he was working at this credit agency, what does that mean that these loans are junky? So there's, let's just use round numbers for the sake of those of us who are challenged by math. 100 loans are in there, and they are loans to a certain type of commercial property, right? Like, right. Here's a building that's at the corner of, you know, Maple and Fairview. They're, you know, like places where you have like small little like mini malls.
Mm-hmm.
This is a building that is perfect for, let's say, like a Walgreens, or maybe a step down for that, because it's not quite so busy. Like, and so the idea was that 10 years ago, this guy's looking at this whole sector and saying, like, this stuff is overinflated. The value of these loans are the property is not so good relative to the amount that they borrowed. Is that basically it?
Right. Because he'd have a kind of broad view of what a certain square footage ought to be bringing in on a cash flow basis, and what the rents ought to be, what the interest rate ought to be. And he would just see some that were a little bit off, and and they were all off in the same direction, you know, benefiting the bank pretty much. And so, you know, he kind of pocketed that away and then saw these same loans starting to come around again.
And by come around again, like, were they coming around again as securities, or were they just like seeing that they're being refinanced at lower rates, which means that presumably the bank has less risk, right?
Right.
If I give you a loan at a lower rate, it's less risk. But these things couldn't have gotten any less riskier. They could have only probably gotten riskier.
Right. And so they're coming around as pieces of mortgage-backed securities. So when pension funds or others, you know, trade these giant packages of securities, what they're actually trading are individual properties kind of sliced up and moved around. But underneath all of that is supposed to be something physical, you know, a Walgreens at the corner of Maple and Walnut. But it's so difficult to pierce all the different layers to get down and say, let's actually check this Walgreens out. Is this Walgreens actually making the amount of money that it says it is? And what I was saying earlier, the way that they would obfuscate it is it used to be called, let's say, the Walgreens building. Now it's called the Greenwald building or the Maple building, or, you know, and because they own entire blocks, often that block has a bunch of different addresses. So the previous address would be 22 Walnut. Now they're putting it under 26 Walnut so that you can't easily search through these proprietary platforms that he has access to say, well, show me all the previous documents for 26 Walnut. And it'd be like, oh, there are none. So he just had to, like, one by one, all right, let me check 28 Walnut. Let me check 26 Walnut, check 22 Walnut. And then finally he'd find one that says, oh, this is the same square footage as the one that was listed under a different name and a different address. Now let me compare these numbers. And boom, lo and behold, every time he'd find that obfuscation, he'd find that the numbers were inflated by something like 30%.
Now, by inflated numbers, so I think everybody understands the concept of, like, okay, I've changed the way that I list this so that it's very difficult to compare these two things. You can't put them on a spreadsheet because they're different names. Can't search for it computer-wise. You have to literally just, like, sleuth it out that way. What does that mean by the numbers are inflated? Like, their revenue is inflated? Mm-hmm. Is that basically it?
Yeah, basically. So the same way that, you know, in the Big Short, they were having bartenders, you know, say that they were making $300,000 a year. And this time they would say this Walgreens made, you know, $300,000 a month in 2016 under the former documents. Now it says they're making $400,000 a month that same year. It's not like they, from one year to another, like, had a big increase, but he was able to get the same year's numbers and compare them, be like, oh, these are off. These are not right. And if it's just a mistake, you'd expect it to go both ways. Sometimes they're accidentally reporting lower. Sometimes they're accidentally reporting higher. He found that almost always they were reporting higher.
Okay. All right. So we need to back up a little bit because I know what you mean when you say the bartender story, but this goes back to 2008. And one of the reasons why we had this massive financial crisis started with people going in. They were getting what were called ninja loans, which is basically no paperwork. We don't have to verify anything. And I'm a loan officer. I'm just originating the loan because I know that this loan is going to get sold to someone else. So I say to you, bartender Ryan, like, dude, I know you make 50, but guess what? You can put down, you make 150.
And the industry term for it became stated loan. And I was involved in one of these once, and the guy where a broker came to me, he's like, we could do a stated loan. I was like, what's a stated loan? He said, well, you just state your income. Like, just state it. And the other name was liar loan.
Right.
But he's a broker. So he's like, well, of course you're not lying. I believe you when you tell me you make $300,000, but please do not give me any paperwork.
Right. Because then I will be obligated to know. And the reason
that might
why it
doesn't sully my commission.
Right. Well, that's right. That guy has a fiduciary responsibility. I mean, at banks, they're called loan officers, right? Like, I mean, that's because you're supposed to project a certain fiduciary responsibility. And if I know that you're not eligible for the loan, I can't make my fees. I don't care if the loan has a high propensity to go bad because I'm selling the loan to else. I'm out of this transaction once I sell it. And so that's what happened. That was a big part of what happened with the financial crisis in 2008, because everybody bought these packages of loans from bartenders or whomever it is. And they think, like, oh, well, these are solid loans. And this guy's making 300 grand a year. He can pay off this mortgage, but it turns out he's not. And when the music stopped and the prices for real estate stopped going up, when he went to go sell that house, he couldn't sell it. and he couldn't sell it except for at a loss. And then everything falls apart. And that is the dynamic that we have here that you're describing in the commercial market. And so where did, like, how prevalent was this lying, going back and lying about what the revenue is for these loans to make these loans look more robust than they actually are?
So one thing that backs up Flynn, who's the whistleblower here, is that two University of Texas researchers dug into this as well and put out a recent study and found it just absolutely rampant. That's not an academic term, but they found it everywhere. And they found the same, roughly the same patterns and numbers holding across the CMBS industry as Flynn did in the ones that he looked at. So it appears to be affecting what they're finding a third to more of the loans.
A third of all the commercial loans in the country are not what the investors think they are, essentially.
That's what the research and Flynn's findings strongly suggest. Yeah.
And how thinly are they dicing up these loans in these packages that they're basically, you know, allegedly misleading investors with? Because, like, there are, you know, dozens in these packages, correct?
Right. The packages can run into the billions, you know, because you have so much money flowing around, partly thanks to the Federal Reserve, that it's looking for these types of investments. You know, for pension funds and others are looking for these types of investments to park money in. And so they'll package these into multi-billion dollar investments that a teacher's pension fund can then purchase, and then they get their, and everybody's happy as long as they're getting their coupon every month. They're getting their interest rate, and they feel like they can sell it at roughly the same or higher rate than they got it before. You know, widespread fraud in general, benefits, you know, all of the different players who are involved until the music stops, and then it hurts all of them, though it hurts the ones with power the least, because they're the ones that can go out and get the bailout. And also, in the meantime, people who are not engaging in fraud are harmed along the way, like a mom and pop who doesn't have access to this type of a scheme to get, say, a lower rent by inflating your cash flow.
Okay. And so there's two things I want to touch on. One is the music stopping. Let's put it this way. How slow was the music prior to COVID? And I think, you know, anybody who lives, around the world, a lot of people not going into work and haven't been, and many won't be returning, at least to those same type of facilities. So the commercial real estate business is hurting big time. How quiet was the music getting, prior to March 2020?
I mean, parts of it were certainly getting quiet as Amazon was taking over the country. And so, you're seeing malls and other stores begin to empty out. It's becoming much more difficult for brick and mortar stores to compete with online. So you were seeing that. The economy was still growing, you know, which helps keep the music playing. And COVID, in a way, cut both ways, because so much money came through the CARES Act and then the subsequent COVID relief package and then this new one, that, you know, those are multiple bailouts, you know, that are multiple times the size of the Wall Street bailout. And you add on top of that the Federal Reserve saying that it was going to backstop a lot of this stuff. So we don't exactly know how this is going to play out. You know, there's certainly a scenario where a lot of people just get away with this and sell all of this, fraudulent stuff to the Federal Reserve at some, through some different mechanism.
There's no mechanism set up to do that now, right? I mean,
they are buying MBS. They are buying CMBS.
Oh, they are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this was part of the original CARES Act, the $500 billion that Treasury had to backstop the Fed going out and basically backstopping.
My recollection is Fed actually did it on their own without legislative authority, saying that this was part of their emergency powers to buy, that they could expand from residential MBS to commercial MBS.
When I hear that, it makes me feel like they've had this problem because I heard about this at this time last year, a month mm-hmm. this. And so it was clearly pre-existing and it was all just rumors and it was all just there's a apparently a very small facility that deals with this type of stuff.
And it's dangerous because it interacts with commercial paper and overnight loans and liquidity. And so that's where the Fed starts to get extra concerned that if you have a kind of liquidity freeze overnight, you could start to see it's just, spiraling seizures in a bunch of different institutions.
And we had an incident like that mm-hmm. a year and a half ago where the Fed stepped in and basically
mm-hmm. right.
Loan market. So is this a situation where the Fed was aware of this problem and they see this crisis and they're like, we're not going to get much scrutiny if we bail this out. We're going to roll this problem into the COVID problem and that's going to help us out.
I think that's certainly part of it. It's not entirely clear how much they know about the details of this. I think since that University of Texas report backed up Flynn's findings, I think that they have to be much more aware of it now. But I think you're right that they saw COVID as both a crisis and an opportunity.
How one of the problems, or the biggest problem that we had in terms of the economy in 2008 was a function of how systemic this leveraging was with these loans. In other words, you had commercial banks and investment banks sort of commingled in such a way that if one of these banks went down, it was going to have a ripple effect through the economy to the point where, like, I knew somebody who worked in consumer consumer debt at one of these banks, and they had basically told their spouse, take every dollar out of the bank, and how it's one thing for the commercial real estate market to crater, right? But what are the ripple effects? Like, how many derivatives down the road are there in this market?
I mean, endless. It's all still interconnected. The hope that for avoiding the type of calamity you're talking about, when from Wall Street executives, is that the Fed just won't allow it to happen. And so when they have too big to fail, and so when you have that comfort level, it does kind of disincentivize you from looking too closely at what's going on in the market. So it's going to be fine.
So some of the originators that are listed that they found were sort of inflating the revenue of these properties. UBS, Ladder Capital, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, having more than 35% of their loans exhibiting 5% or greater income overstatement. Just to be clear, what this means is, like, the guy had two sets of papers. Set A had all the revenue for the year 2018 of, those places at Walnut and Main Street. And set B had the same revenue, same places, but the revenue was just higher in that same year. This is just lying. And so are there regulators? Like, is there somebody at the, I don't know what agency it would be. You tell me. Is there somebody Fed or at the SEC or both saying, like, hey, wait a second, maybe that's something we should check in, or maybe we should just pretend like we got the Intercept is a block site at our right. computers.
Right. And so, as I said earlier, because the fraud benefits so many of the people involved in this, there aren't a lot of people who are incentivized to look after it. But the one person who is incentivized is a whistleblower. There are whistleblower laws that if you bring to the SEC significant fraud that they can prove, you get a massive chunk of that. I forget exactly what it is. It's somewhere between 10 and 30%.
Yes, it's a TTAM case. It's a right. There are laws that incentivize whistleblowers to see when the U.S. government laws are being broken in that way.
So when I said Flynn engaged in this extremely laborious process, it's not because he's just a total either crank or, imbued with nobility on behalf of retailers across the country. You know, if he has filed his complaint with the SEC, and if the SEC does find that it has merit and pursues these cases, then he stands to profit from it. So the answer to your question is the SEC. And I guess that would be Gary Gensler now that he's on his way through. So, there is a real possibility that this gets investigated seriously.
What is the role of ratings agencies in the commercial real estate? I'm not aware, because they played such an integral role in the last financial collapse.
Very similar role. And this shows that, you can only rely on them. I mean, you can't really rely on them if you want a kind of forensic look at the paperwork that is underlying these securities that are being marketed. They're not really set up to do the kind of work that he did. The prospectuses alone on these things are like close to 500 pages, and that's before you've looked at the actual documents. And like I said, they don't make the documents remotely easy to analyze. So the credit rating agencies are basically looking at the prospectuses and saying that, if this is true, what the prospectus is saying, then this is legitimate. If you want somebody who's going to do that, then they're a fine person to check out, but they're not somebody who's going to say that the prospectus is necessarily true or not.
This is to extend that analogy with the bartender. Everybody is going on the stated formula here. Well, they said it, so
we looked at the paper. It says 300,000.
This is just a series of
stamp it.
You have CYAs all the way through the system. So, all right. So that story's out there. It'll be interesting to see what Gensler does, because I would say of any of the people that the Biden administration could have put in that position, Gensler, based upon his last go through, might be inclined to actually pursue. Mm-hmm. What else did you find about this market? I mean, I don't want to steal the thunder for whatever future pieces that you're going to be writing. But broadly speaking, in this market, were there other sort of systemic issues that you came across? You've been reporting this out for months and months and months. Were there other systemic issues within that market?
There is a kind of big versus little divergence that came out of it, just from looking through all these different numbers. So, for instance, these major banks work with a lot of these major retailers as their huge clients, and so we write a lot about Ladder Capital and Dollar General as one of our main examples, and so you have to imagine that there is a Dollar General vice president and a Ladder Capital, vice president, who have regular meetings. Ladder owns something like 91 properties, or did a couple years ago, probably more now, 91 properties that have Dollar Generals in them. So, they're doing bulk business together. And so even aside from all of this, the paperwork shenanigans that we uncovered, just the act of this major bank doing business with this many Dollar Generals is going to benefit Dollar General in the sense that they're going to be able to shake a slightly lower rent out of these banks. Rent is is generally the number one cost for a brick and mortar small business, and so Dollar General's ability to undercut other businesses in the area on pricing is benefited by them being by being so big and having these good relationships with these global financial institutions, whereas a mom and pop who's trying to compete with them, they're just going to either the local bank or a major bank and showing them their paperwork and getting whatever loan the bank will give them, and so then they have to charge a bit more for their products, and ultimately they're going to lose that fight.
If I understand you, Ladder has this bulk relationship with Dollar General. We're going to give you these massive loans. we're okay with your numbers.
Although it's not even clear Dollar General even knows that what's going
on the other side.
On the other side.
Okay, and but because Ladder turns around, they sell the loans. Right. So that's the way they're making their money. Right. And so they're going to give Dollar General they're going to give Dollar General better rates, but it doesn't matter because they're going to those securities, and they're going to make it up on that end. And so nobody's the wiser. Again, I mean, that's the beauty, the horror of this, is that everybody's making money until we, as a society, have to bail them out. And that's the big problem. Ryan, great job here on this reporting. The story is Wall Street's cookbooks fueled the financial crisis in 2008. It's happening again. Thank you so much for joining us. Your kids definitely did seem excited that you were on.
Yes, they sure were. They're big fans of the show.
Yes, I'm glad to hear that. All right, Ryan Grimm, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks,
really
Ryan.
Appreciate it.
All right, see you later.
We'll take a quick break. I know, you know, like Ryan's kids are so invested in him coming on this program.
I know, they're big fans.
They follow. They follow all the stuff that he does.
They're big fans of me, not you, so much.
Well, it doesn't. We don't need to get that. We don't need to slice it that
much.
I mean, it's true.
I think we do.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. We'll resolve this. So with just a minute or two left here, I mean, it is an open question as to what happens now with, and even let's be honest, the bill that's in Congress now, the police reform bill that has George Floyd's name attached to it, still is insufficient. I mean, it just simply is. It's a good sign that there's some movement, but it's insufficient. And the bottom line is that none of this, neither the bill that's in Congress nor this verdict, and nor the verdict that could come in August with the cops who are just watching this go down, none of that is nearly sufficient. And there is going to be an attempt, as we saw at the top of the show, whether it's coming from the right or whether it's coming from, you know, the center, as it were, the mainstream narrative, there's going to be an attempt to use this moment as if it represents some type of wholesale change. And the fact is, it doesn't. You see a lot of pieces out there that, you know, this
well,
video
easier for people. It's easier, like, even if it's not a nefarious thing, it's easier for people to feel that this watershed moment changed everything. It's
right.
Like a storybook.
And no, it did not. It didn't change really. It didn't change anything. It
changed the lives of George Floyd's family.
Indeed. Indeed. But in terms of the broader issues associated with this, it didn't change anything because just as we're savvy enough to know that it's about Keith Ellison and this one decision to give it to an attorney general as opposed to this DA, the cops and police departments all around the country know the same thing. And their behavior is not going to change in any way. All right. That's it for us today. We will see you again tomorrow. Except for those of you who are still here, in which case we will see you now. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. We got a lot of stuff to cover.
Is it just us today?
Is it just us today?
Brandon's on tomorrow.
It's just us today. We will take some phone calls. We'll have a little more time for phone calls today. That's good. And there you go. See that?
Beautiful.
That sound means that the phones are now on, ladies and gentlemen. We're taking your IMs. I just got an IM from MIDI Doctors reminding everybody, hit the like button and subscribe. And poggers. Oh, maybe should I tip this a little bit? All right, I will. I was gonna hold off on this, but I'm not gonna do it. It's too exciting. There's stuff that's happening that you should know about, folks. I have two words for you. Majority Discord.
Oh.
In fact, it's one word. Majority Discord. And then if you add a .com to it, you can join our Discord community that we have launched. This has been in the making for nearly a decade.
Even before Discord. I don't know what Discord is.
There you go. Discord
is. Please tell
me. Discord is essentially like the equivalent of a Slack channel, but it is it's a community. You know, it's sort of like the old bulletin boards, but just updated technology. But the idea is it's like a place where people listening to the show, regardless, you know, like a lot of people, they listen or watch on the show on Twitch a lot of times, or they listen or watch on YouTube or on Facebook or on the app, or they just audio only. And sometimes they want to cross the stream, as it were.
Oh.
And maybe you want to communicate with the community at large.
Cross
streams.
Right.
And this is a way of them going into and having a conversation with other Majority Report listeners and or viewers, and go in there and I'm going to start to get into it. It's one of those things like where I'm not with the kids. I'll be dipping in and out, and I will show you how to work the whole thing. You could dip in and out of there, and there it is. Accept the invite. And look at that. We have 96 members already. How did that happen?
Even before you announced.
Even before we even announced it. The word is spreading. We were supposed to, there was supposed to be, well, so much for, there. Look at that. Poggers, Far Effing Out, Uncle Sam's Discord, Pog, Yaz. Look at that. Woo, we're free now.
I'm a little bummed out that I don't know what Discord is, but you, the boomer, does.
No, I'm not technically a boomer. You know that, right?
I mean,
you know
that. Well.
I mean, pretty close, but I'm not. Not a boomer. No. Folks can head over to that Discord, majoritydiscord.com. We'll take you there. See that? So.
Majority Discord.
Yep. Also, don't forget, it's your support that, makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, but, you help us build things like the, Discord, server and, integrating our different platforms and all that. And also, you get the fun half of the show. Delivered in the format that you want it. So jointhemajorityreport.com. jointhemajorityreport.com.
Like this stream.
And also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. And check out the AM Quickie. That's right. 7 minutes of headlines every morning. It's there before a lot of you wake up. It's there often before I wake up even. So check it out. AMQuickie.com. All right, 646-257-30. Wait, what am I talking about? What's happening on Matt? What's happening on the in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, tomorrow night we got Nando Vila of Jacobin Weekends and Woke Bros to talk about the Super League, or what's left of it. And we will also have what?
It's falling apart.
That appears to be so. Yeah, I haven't followed up on it today, but a lot of teams pulled out yesterday as we were wrapping the show up. We're also going to have Charmaine Chua on to talk about her piece in Jacobin. Organizing against Amazon requires strategizing across global supply chains. So we're going to get a little bit of culture and a little bit of a serious infrastructure and organizing talk. So that's tomorrow night, Left Reckoning at 8 o'clock Eastern time. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get the post game.
That builds on a point that Rich Schiselson made when he came on the program to talk about one of the problems with Amazon is that you can unionize 20 shops and it doesn't implicate the other shops at all. You could shut them down. You could have a work stoppage at those, and it really doesn't impact their business because their business is so disaggregated in that way, that part of their business. I like the global supply chain. Looking at that, that's pretty good. Also, don't forget, Nomi's show is happening at 3 p.m. today, as it does every day after the show, except for on Mondays. So you can head over to youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow, youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow, or twitch.tv/The_NomiKey_show. See you in the fun half.
So